Malacanang shrugs off the International Criminal Court's approval for a full-blown probe into the bloody war on drugs. President Duterte renews his call for a state audit of the Philippine Red Cross as he once again hits Senator and PRC Chairman Richard Gordon. Tax officials identify over 200 social media influencers who will be checked if they are complying with tax laws. And we'll tackle the Philippines' looming energy crisis with Energy Undersecretary Wimpy Fuentebella and Alberto de Luzon of the Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Hey, thanks for joining us. And for those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, nice to have you with us today. We begin with Malacanang's response to the International Criminal Court pre-trial chamber's approval of an investigation into the Duterte administration's war on drugs. The chamber says the bloody anti-drug campaign is not a legitimate law enforcement operation, but a widespread and systematic attack against the civilian population. The ICC's probe will also cover the killings in Davao City from November 2011 to June 30, 2016, when President Duterte served as both the mayor and the vice mayor there. The chamber adds, while the Philippines withdrew from the Rome Statute, which created the ICC, the court retains jurisdiction over alleged crimes that occurred from 2011 up to the time of the country's withdrawal in 2019. But Presidential Chief Legal Counsel Salvador Panelo insists the ICC never had jurisdiction over the Philippines. Panelo reiterates government will not cooperate with the probe and that ICC investigators will be barred from entering the country. He also accused the ICC of allowing itself to be used for political propaganda. Human rights group iDefend challenges the Philippine government to cooperate with the ICC if it has nothing to hide. iDefend was among the first groups to condemn President Duterte's drug war back in 2016. For attorney Ruben Carranza of the International Center for Transitional Justice says the palace may also appeal the ICC chamber's decision to authorize the investigation.
There's a chamber in the ICC that is meant for appeals, and the Philippines as a state that has jurisdiction over the crimes can appeal to that chamber, and that chamber will have to rule within a reasonable time on that appeal. While that is going on, the prosecutor is not stopped from actually conducting investigations. The prosecutor is also not stopped from seeking warrants of arrest or summons. At this stage, what the prosecutor will assemble is proof that identifies, that links each suspect that she will name when she files charges against them.
For the group Human Rights Watch, the ICC decision offers a much-needed check on President Duterte and his bloody war on drugs. Joining us now is Carlos Conde. He's senior researcher of Human Rights Watch. Caloy, nice to see you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
All right. So the ICC formally authorizing an official probe into alleged crimes against humanity in Duterte's bloody drug war, that it includes the time when he was mayor and vice mayor in Davao City up to the time of the withdrawal from the ICC. How significant will this be in the course of the investigation, Caloy?
Well, this is quite significant, and this is a momentous occasion, obviously, for the families of the victims of not just of the drug war, but of the Davao Death Squad killings. The fact that the ICC pretrial chamber included the killings from 2011 to 2016 is hugely, hugely important because they're trying to establish that this was a very systematic and widespread crimes against humanity, and there are tons of evidence, of witnesses, of information that they can access to try to prove their case. And as you know, what happened in Davao, and I was a journalist living there, I lived there. This was one of the things that got me busy when I was there. There was a clear-cut, scenario there of a state policy that was later on used as a template for the war on drugs across the Philippines. So Davao.
Let's talk about that, Caloy. I just want to bring in this tweet that you sent out a couple of hours back. You said you lived with and documented this violence as a journalist, a Davao City resident, and now a human rights advocate for much of your adult life. You say this is important to you, but even more so to the thousands of mostly poor Filipinos who suffered under Duterte. Tell us more about what you saw, what you had to live through, both as a resident and as a journalist in Davao City. Caloy.
Well, I had a mixed kind of experience in Davao. I mean, Davao was a nice place to live in, except that we paid a heavy price for that, and that price came with the violence, with the bloodshed that was happening. You know, living there, you're always bombarded with reports or sights of people being killed in the streets or being assassinated, and not just by riding in tandem, but also by people who were just unidentified killers who were just knifing people in the streets. And this was a part of Davao's campaign to rid the city of the dregs of society, as they call them there. And these are mostly, you know, children, street children, people from the slums. One of the mothers I interviewed and made a story of while there was Carita Alia, who lost 4 sons, 3 of them minors, from 2001 to 2007. And clearly their case are not included in the ICC case. But, you know, as I also tweeted earlier today, it provides you a glimpse of what was going on in Davao and what was later done across the country. So it was a horrific time to be living in that city at the time under this mayor. Horrific in the, you know, because of the brutality of it, because a lot of the people there just accepted what was happening.
Let me just go back to the point that you made, that it was really something that was against the poor. And you said that this was sort of used as a template when he became president of the country eventually. And this is sort of confirmed by the president himself. A couple of weeks back when he had an address, he sort of said, "Akala ko mga durugista lang ang kalaban ko." So there you see that he was really just after the users and not really the ones who were responsible in bringing the drugs into the Philippines, the large organized groups and all that. But a while ago, you also said, Caloy, that, you know, there's evidence to back these claims. But while you speak of evidence, the palace says it's all about political propaganda. Tell us why it isn't.
Well, it's predictable of the palace to say that. I mean, their backs are against the wall right now. All those testimony, all those witnesses, all those reports that have come out, not just from Human Rights Watch, not just from journalists like me at the time, but many, many others, testimonies and court records, even police records, those are now coming to haunt this administration. And then the predictable response, dismissing this as just political propaganda, I mean, that's just, to me, that's obscene. I mean, that's just spitting on the grave of the thousands and thousands of victims in this violent campaign by the president way back in Davao City. So really, the palace needs to respond to this more than that. I mean, it cannot just dismiss this, because we have to keep in mind that the ICC is a very rigorous judicial institution. They determine, you know, the basis for even, you know, I mean, we have also to keep in mind that what the ICC is doing right now, it's not passing judgment on the evidence right now on the case. What it's saying is that there is reasonable basis to conduct an investigation into these killings. It's not even saying now that Duterte or whoever is guilty. It's not even named Duterte yet. It just mentions a state policy of killings that needed to be investigated. And it even says in the decision that as they investigate this and they find that there's not a reason to move forward, then they will not move forward. So it's all about the evidence that's going to be presented. We don't know yet who's going to be prosecuted, who's going to be arrested, because this is still an investigation.
You've heard about what the president's chief legal counsel said. Salvador Panelo said that the ICC chamber's decision neither bothers nor troubles the president and his administration. Should they be?
Well, you know, the very... I chuckle at that idea that they're not bothered by this, because clearly, and in fact, this is now encroaching into the elections next year. This, all the responses by the government, particularly in these elections, are in preparation for this. They are deathly aware, afraid of what the ICC can do. So that's why the ICC's investigations is going to shape the elections in the coming year. That's why, in my view, they are going to make sure that whoever is an ex-president is going to be somebody close to the president. It can be Bongo, it can be Sara Duterte. So that, to me, shows that they are very, very afraid of this. And no one can protect President Duterte from the ICC, from the long arm of the law, except those closest to him. We have to keep that in mind as we move forward.
And finally, Caloy, to those who are sort of pessimistic, who sees this as really a non-development, what do you say to those who think that, what good would this do? This administration is about to end its lifetime. And yet you hear that the president is, of course, going to a run for vice president in the next elections. What good will an investigation still provide the country at this point?
Well, this investigation is going to it's sort of like a balm to the suffering of a lot of the victims of the drug war and of the killings in Davao. This will, you know, embolden them to seek further justice. This will be justice to them. Even at this stage, at this very, very early stage of this investigation, this already means a lot to them. But more importantly, as we move forward, this investigation and hopefully the conviction and the arrest and the conviction that will happen will deter, hopefully, you know, future leaders of this country from doing what Duterte has done. There has got to be a better way of addressing the problems of the society other than killing people.
Carlos Conde, senior researcher of Human Rights Watch. Nice to see you again, Caloy. Take care and you keep safe.
Thank you to Casey and good luck.
Thanks. All right, moving on to other news this noon. President Duterte calls the Senate probe into government's allegedly anomalous pandemic spending a witch hunt. Duterte insists there is no corruption in the health department's procurement of medical supplies. He adds he will still allow Health Secretary Francisco Duque III and Vaccine Chief Carlito Galvez Jr. to attend the hearings. But other secretaries will have to get his consent first. Duterte also praised the House Committee on Good Government and Public Accountability for its own probe into the controversy.
In the House, as I was informed, everybody were given a chance. Those who were called to testify were able to complete their story, and it is a more sane inquiry because ang mga witnesses nakapagsalita ng kanilang totoong sagot.
The president again went after Senate Blue Ribbon Committee Chairman Richard Gordon. He called him a despot. Duterte says he's ordering Solicitor General Jose Calida to have the commission and audit scrutinize the Philippine Red Cross, which Gordon heads.
Men judge best when they condemn. Ganun yan si despot. Tapos sabi niya, may narinig pa ako, sabi niya na natatakot na ako. Sus Mario Joseph Gordon. Hindi mo ako matakot na in a million years. Hindi ako kawatan kagaya mo. Wala akong Red Cross na ginagatasan araw-araw. Ikaw, meron kang nakaparking dyan. Yan, pinarking mo yung milk and cow mo, ang Red Cross na yan. Ito, ka.
Meanwhile, Presidential Chief Legal Counsel Salvador Panelo calls out the Senate after Blue Ribbon Committee Chairman Richard Gordon accused President Duterte of inciting to sedition. Panelo believes it's actually the Senate that's guilty of that crime. He says the Senate is restraining the executive branch from addressing the pandemic by summoning government officials to their hearings. But senators are unfazed. They vowed to continue the probe despite President Duterte's continued attacks.
Hindi naman pwedeng pigilan ng executive department yung mga hindi government officials. Ang pwede lang pigilan yung mga cabinet officials. Pero si Michael lang, hindi naman kabinete yun. O yung si Ong, at saka ito si Christopher Lau, hindi na siya gobyerno.
The Commission on Audit toning down its findings on government's multi-billion peso deal with Farmily Pharmaceuticals. The state auditor denies describing the purchased medical supplies as overpriced, nor was there any ghost purchase. COA Chair Michael Aguinaldo made that clarification during Wednesday's House probe on government's pandemic spending. It was also played back during President Duterte's state speech this morning.
Masasabi ko lang po is wala po sa COA report ng PSBBM ang statement na may overpricing po. There's no statement to that. The observations related more to inventory management than overpricing. So hindi po tama na sabihin ang COA ang nagsabi na may overprice.
Metro Manila's residents woke up to a new pandemic alert system today. Under Alert Level 4, granular lockdowns will be imposed in areas with a high number of COVID-19 infections. But Metro Manila's mayors say even just two positive cases could result in an entire street being locked down. All of those affected by these granular lockdowns will receive food assistance instead of the usual cash aid. The Metro Manila Development Authority also says curfew hours will be adjusted.
Curfew ay adjust namin from 8 o'clock gagawin na pong 10 o'clock, 10 to 4 a.m. At habang po may pilot, no, ay kami po ay tuloy-tuloy pa rin magpapabakuna dahil sa ngayon po ang nabakunado sa Metro Manila ay 61.85%. In one month, posibleng maging 80% na po ang dalawang dose na may bakuna sa Metro Manila. And by December 13, the rate we are going, pinakamaliit po ay 88%.
The Philippines recorded close to 17,000 new COVID infections Wednesday. It's the lowest daily tally in nearly 2 weeks. But the health department again blames this on lower laboratory outputs. The positivity rate, meanwhile, stands at 25.9%, down from yesterday's peak of almost 30%. 214 more patients have died, while another 24,000 have recovered. We're going to take a break now. Up ahead, we'll talk about the looming energy crisis here in the Philippines with Energy Undersecretary Wimpy Fuentevella and Alberto de Luzon III of the Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities. You're watching Dateline Philippines here on ANC.
We
are back. You're still with Dateline Philippines here on ANC. Here's another look at our headlines this noon. Malacanang shrugs off the International Criminal Court's approval for a full-blown probe into the bloody war on drugs. President Duterte renews his call for a state audit of the Philippine Red Cross as he once again hits Senator and PRC Chairman Richard Gordon. And tax officials identify over 200 social media influencers who will be checked if they are complying with tax laws. Back with more news, the Philippines ready for any potential terror attack. That's according to Defense Secretary Delphine Lorenzana as he allays concerns over Japan's warning of terror attacks in Southeast Asia, including the Philippines. The military says the security level in the country remains at moderate. This means there is no perceived attack at the moment. Lorenzana says government troops are constantly ramping up their monitoring and intelligence gathering efforts.
Itong ating bansa ay napakarami ng experience sa terror acts, ano? Itong nakaraang 20 taon. Kaya sa gabandang akin, hindi na natin kailangan pa ang warning na yan dahil alam natin ang gagawin natin. Alam natin ang mga consequences ng terror attack. As of now, wala namang report yung intelligence community about foreign terrorists na nag-operate dito. So as far as we're concerned, wala. Ang ating minamanmanan ngayon ay yung mga local. Meron tayong trilateral maritime at saka aerial patrols with Malaysia and Indonesia. Nagdagdag tayo ng mga barko dyan, yung madaliit na barko dyan sa border at hinaharang natin at binamonitor natin yung mga pagpasok na galing sa kabila.
The Philippines poll body is considering extending voting hours in the 2022 polls due to the pandemic. The Commission on Elections says voting hours could be stretched up to 9 in the evening beyond the 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. window, especially in COVID-19 hotspots.
Titingnan natin yung flow ng botante on the day na kasi the NBank naman can decide it immediately. Kung titingin natin, marami pang hindi nakaboto because of the pandemic, pwede tayo mag-ikipang oras, dalawang oras, tatlong oras.
If everyone were to come like sunod-sunod, darating lang sila regularly,
okay,
then kayang-kaya to. That's a lot of time, no? We have 12 hours to begin with.
But the COMELEC says it cannot hold multi-day elections. That's because Congress would have to amend the Constitution and double the budget needed for the salary of teachers acting as poll workers. 6.5 million Filipinos were removed from the voters list after not showing up in two consecutive elections. That's according to Elections Commissioner Rowena Guanzon. She says they can still reactivate their status by contacting their local COMELEC offices.
Pwede naman silang mag-reactivate through email. Walang kayo sa COMELEC website, lahat ng email na aming regional offices o election officer ninyo ay nandyan. Para mag-reactivate, hindi na kailangan pumunta ang COMELEC office, mag-email po kayo sa inyong election officer.
The Ateneo's Martial Law Museum calls out actress Tony Gonzaga for featuring the son of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos in her latest vlog. See, during that interview, former Senator Bongbong Marcos talked about the greatest lessons he learned from his dad and how the country supposedly benefited from his rule. The Martial Law Museum described this as an attempt to whitewash the numerous atrocities and human rights violations committed under the Marcos dictatorship. The museum also reminded Gonzaga to use her celebrity status for the common good and not for propaganda. It invited her to sit down with victims of the Marcos regime instead. Well, the whole country is focused on the battle against COVID-19, and rightly so. Thousands of lives lost, and the end is nowhere in sight. There's another possible crisis, though, set to hit the country in a few years' time, and it's going to affect everyone. We're talking about the depletion of Malampaya, the country's sole natural gas field, supplying a big portion of the country's energy needs. But even before we talk about that, power outages are already being experienced in several parts of the country. And yet consumers have had to pay more. Something just doesn't make sense. Let's get to the bottom of it. Joining us now, Alberto de Luz of the Third. He is Energy Transition Advisor at the Institute of Climate and Sustainable Cities. Bert, good afternoon to you, and thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you coming to the show.
Good afternoon, Carmina. Happy to be back.
All right. So let's talk about the power outages. Is it true that we are already experiencing power outages in several parts of the country?
Well, we all experienced it last May to June in Luzon. And based on reports, we've heard from the DOE, actually, that there was a power outage in Eastern Visayas. Also, we've read from a website of a power-related company that Mindanao has been experiencing some of these outages. So I think that we are all, we can say for ourselves, if we've experienced the outage, I think in Luzon, we can definitely say there were rotating blackouts at the end of May, the start of June.
Something doesn't make sense, though, Bert, because despite the power outages, consumers have had to shell out more to pay for their electricity. How does that make sense? Help us make sense of it.
Yes, well, you know, the way we've set up our power system, we have a spot market. And actually, if the reserve is low, in other words, the difference between supply and demand is low, then the prices shoot up because you have to use the more expensive power plants. You have to dispatch more expensive power plants. So if we're seeing the outages, we would normally expect the rates at the spot market to also increase. And I was just eyeballing it, and I've noted that it has been increasing for the last three quarters, for example. In other words, reserves have been lower. Getting lower in the last three quarters.
Why is the system built that way?
Well, you see, the spot market is meant for a way for us to dispatch efficiently. It's actually a signal. If the spot market gives us higher rates, then that means that our reserves are getting lower. Mm-hmm. So that's the job of the spot market. So what I normally do is I check. In this case, I'm looking at average generator prices, for example, per quarter. And if I see a spike, that means that the more expensive generators are being dispatched. And therefore, the difference between supply and demand is narrowing. Now, normally, in a normal situation, the rates at the spot market would sort of be at a relatively low level, you know, between 2 and 3 pesos per kilowatt hour. Once we see it go higher, then, to me, that's a signal that reserves are getting lower.
Mm. With the way you're explaining it to us, Bert, it seems like it's actually more beneficial for some of these companies when there are power outages, because that's when they rake in the big bucks, Bert.
Well, in an article that I co-wrote, I think we noted the correlation between the outages and the spikes in prices at the market. And that is because if you're, like in that particular case, a large coal-fired power plant, the largest, for example, in our system, then every time you have an unplanned outage, you immediately have a significant impact in the spot market. So normally our large power plants are baseload power plants. So if any one of them goes, then we will feel it in our spot market. If several of them go at the same time, like what happened in May to June, then we have the rolling blackouts that we probably can still remember.
Mm. So what's the way out? I mean, this cannot go on forever.
Yes. I think every time you see a situation where you have higher prices and therefore lower reserve, then there are several things to look at. Is it the demand? Is the demand high? Obviously not. We're in a pandemic. Is it the supply? What we've found out at ICSC is we've seen the unreliability of the coal-fired power plants in the Philippines. It's serious enough that I can now call, for example, I can now call Cole, and there was thunder before I'm saying this.
Was that thunder?
Yes, it was. So anyway, I can see Yusek Quimpy react. Anyway, I am calling Cole intermittent. Because to me, intermittent means you stop and you start at irregular intervals. Now, that's exactly the definition of intermittent. I look at the graph of operating performance of the coal sector as a whole, segments of it, for example, just the pulverized coal plants, the CFBs, and I see in all cases very high levels of outages and unavailability. That's not something that we expect, you know, as energy people. We expect our baseload power plants to be reliable. We expect them to be on every time they complete their regular maintenance, and we expect them to be free from all of these unplanned outages. That's not what I've seen.
All right. So, Bert, if you see this, and if your findings underscore the unreliability of coal, governments should also see this. And if they do, are you satisfied with the way they're reacting to this and possibly planning for the future to address this?
Well, Carmina, you know, late last year, October, I recall, DOE itself issued a coal moratorium. I think they're ahead of us, actually. They're seeing it. Probably they're seeing that there's a need to address it. And I've seen very recently in the DOE the new paradigms. For example, in the last Philippine Energy Plan, they are talking about a paradigm shift towards renewable energy, which I sort of like. I'm in favor of that. I'm also seeing that they've got these new initiatives. The Green Energy Option is an initiative of this administration. The Green Energy Auction, as opposed to the Green Energy Option, which they are also seeking to fully implement. So I think that the DOE sees the problem, is addressing it. And of course, all of us can say, well, maybe more can be done. And I think that's the direction that is being taken.
Well, there's another problem that's looming in the horizon. Malampaya set to run out of natural gas soon. How will this complicate things?
Well, Malampaya is a very significant resource. I think looking at the information from the DOE, about 19-20% of our energy comes from the Malampaya power plant. So it's very significant. But I'd like to say that, you see, as far as Malampaya is concerned, remember DOE is on top of the oil and gas service contract system. Malampaya is a gas resource. DOE issued the service contract. And DOE is in the best position to tell us what is the status of that resource, what are the plans that the service contractor has, and what kind of mechanisms the DOE is looking at to ensure that that issue doesn't harm us. Personally, I've been in the energy sector for a long time. I've talked with some of my geologist friends. Apparently, there are what they call several plays that can be done with the gas field at Malampaya. And I hope that that is an option that we can all see. No?
But if that's going to happen soon, Bert, shouldn't we be seeing some sort of a woven plan? So that it won't stop, it won't begin when we stop here. You know what I'm saying? You get what I'm saying?
Yes.
So that it's going to be seamless.
Yes, I think that the issue has never been raised to the level that maybe it should. And I'd be happy for the DOE to explain exactly their plans for the Malampaya. I know the technical people at DOE are competent. You know, I've worked in the DOE for a long, long time. I continue to be engaged with them. So I know that they're aware of the situation. And I myself, I haven't had the opportunity to discuss this in detail. I hope that there is a plan that DOE will pursue towards this. because it's a very, we have over 3,000 megawatts of power capacity dependent on Malambaya. And you know that I am an advocate for renewable energy. I think a gas resource is essential to help us ease into the energy transition.
Okay, and finally, before we let you go, just going full circle now, power outages happening, some companies profiting from the misery of people due to these power outages. What is it in the DOE's power to prevent this from happening and therefore easing the burden on the consumer, Bert?
Well, you know, DOE has oversight over the power sector. And DOE, in collaboration with the ERC, can put in place the mechanisms to avert this. You know, penalties can be put in place. I'm not a lawyer, but I've looked at the penalties, for example, medyo, they don't sound like penalties to me. But Yusek Wimpy is a lawyer himself. I think he should be aware of the situation and should be in a position to really provide the answers on that part of the problem. I think that it's important. It's important for us to realize exactly what it is. Mm. It's unreliability of certain power plants. It's a loop. It's the service contract, I suppose, expiring in 2024, and maybe what we need to do to address that, a potential supply issue. But having seen what the DOE has done recently with the coal moratorium, RE paradigm shift, green energy auction, etc., I think that I'd be willing to give DOE the ability to help us through this. And I'd be excited to hear what DOE will say.
All right. So on that note, we're going to have to let you go for now. Bert Dalusong III of the Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Take care. All right. So moving now, still on this same topic, we're going to hear the side of the government now joining us, Undersecretary of the Energy Department, Wimpy Fuentebella. Undersecretary, thanks for waiting. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for joining us today. So let me cut to the chase here. What are you doing when you hear of power outages and, you know, some of these companies profiting from it? But it's the whole design of the system.
That's right.
And, but also you're going to have to safeguard the consumers as well. So what are you doing with regard to this situation, Undersecretary?
Okay, number one, as far as, let's talk about years, no? 2017, Secretary Cusi came out with a liquefied nat gas policy. So this enables us to import liquefied natural gas in anticipation of the Malampaya situation. That's 2017. In 2018, Secretary Cusi came up with a competitive selection process. That is where the distribution utilities will have the ability to safeguard consumers from the volatility of price of the prices in the spot market. So what does that mean? Magkokontrata sila, yung distribution utilities like Meralco and the electric cooperatives, to the suppliers para fixed yung rate, tapos pababaan siya, tapos transparent siya. That's 2018. And then in 2019, ang sabi rin ng DOE, yung ancillary services, which is the reserve, or which is used to balance the grid so that if one outage happens, there is a reserve that nasasalo at hindi ihuhulog yung consumer. And sabi ng DOE through Secretary Cusi, dapat firm contracting. Hindi siya yung non-firm. So dapat nandyan siya, available when needed. So in 2020, the policy naman na nilabas ni DOE is the Grid Operations and Maintenance Program. Yun yung sinasabi na huwag kayong magsabay-sabay ng schedule ng maintenance. Kasi mataas ang paggamit ng kuryente, especially during the second quarter for Luzon. So yun yung mga policy. So what is the answer? No? For volatility, dapat talaga nag-o-order the distribution utility contracting and nandun din si system operator NGCP to contract ancillary services so that we increase supply. So when the supply increases and it is a protected tariff because it's it underwent competitive selection process and it's fixed, the exposure sa WESM ng bills natin will probably be about 5, 10, or 15% only.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the strategy that we did. So how do we move forward? Comply. Now, okay.
Secretary. Comply.
Yes.
But, you know, and all those you just mentioned actually sound good. But here's the thing. Two things, actually. Consumers still have had to pay more. And number two, there were still unplanned power outages.
The unplanned power outage happens. That's why you need the reserves or ancillary services. It's like a breakdown that happens to your car.
Mm.
So it's just a matter of foreseeing and allocating the reserves. So there is already that in the system.
Mm-hmm.
4% regulating reserve, biggest plant, contingency reserve, and a second biggest plant in the system, dispatchable reserve. It's already there. It just needs to be filled up with contracting. So, we mentioned penalties. Under Section 46 of EPIRA, the DOE does not have penalty powers. It's with the Energy Regulatory Commission. But the DOE went further. Mm-hmm. Because when we saw that there were some industry players that were not complying or were not willing to comply or were dragging their feet in compliance, we already informed the cabinet to already alert the Energy Regulatory Commission, the Philippine Competition Commission, and the Department of Justice. We did that last March because we see that there are refusals from the industry players to comply with these policies. Why did we inform ERC and PCC to look into anti-competitive behavior? Uh-huh. Nandoon yung sinasabi natin na, oh, may bumagsak na planta, bakit may kumikita pa?
Correct.
So, competitive ba yon?
Correct. Yung
sila ang titingin doon.
Kasi pero hindi talaga namin, maganda eh. Hindi talaga maganda sa paningin eh.
Oo, hindi talaga maganda. Sabi nga, may collusion. Sabi ko nga, di ba doon sa hearing noong November 2013, sinabi na ng former Chief Justice natin in the questioning, no, na you don't need collusion to prove collusion because the law uses anti-competitive behavior, which is a European concept that enables the regulator to look at the trend. Mm-hmm. But sabi namin, the DOE went further. Why did it include the DOJ?
Mm.
Because we see non-compliance as a form of a white-collar crime, no?
Mm.
It's one way of doing economic sabotage. So we look at the elements of how the government should impose or insist in compliance.
But in the end,
it's not only the power bills, no? It's also making sure na nandiyan yung mga health facilities running, relying on electricity.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make sure that all these necessary activities for the economy to rebound is in place.
Yeah, so, but Undersecretary, despite all that, we just heard from Bert De Luzon, who said that recently, during the time of this pandemic, there have been power outages and there have been companies who profited from these outages.
Hindi siya connected kasi yung nangyari naman dito sa Eastern Samar na binabanggit niya, that was because of the calamity na dumaan yung bagyo. Hindi siya supply problem. Kadalasan, ang outage kasi does not only happen when your power bank, kaya ka low bat sa cellphone mo, your power bank or your battery is low on power. It also happens that the wire, when you charge your cellphone, has a problem. And pag dinaanan niya ng bagyo, minsan nagkakaroon ng problem, nagkakaroon ng tripping. Yung sabi nila, ano yung trip? Naputol po siya, hindi makadaloy.
Mm-hmm.
So yan, nandiyan na naman yung resiliency policy ni Sec. Pusi 2018. Why am I emphasizing the years? Because it's already 2021. And the compliance should be there. Kahit may pandemic, we should comply. Because right now, there is a power outage that is being experienced in Batanes because of the bagyo also. Pero hindi naman makatawid yung task force kapatid namin kasi may protocol din sa Batanes ng provincial LGU.
Yeah, answer me this.
We have to make sure to identify the problem. Mm. Is it wire or is it supply? Now, if it is your power bill, we encourage you to go to Energy Literacy Philippines in YouTube and go directly to understanding your power bills and shift to 6:15, 6 minutes 15, so that you will know that under the Magna Carta for Consumers, the ERC has rules. Mm. If you have questions on your power bill, you inform your distribution utility like Meralco, and there is a process for that. And Meralco should respond within 15 days or any other distribution utility. Otherwise, you can bring it up to the Energy Regulatory Commission. So it's always pointing to DOE or
you have to be specific. I mean, you've been in government for quite a long time now.
Yes.
And you know that sometimes it's really easier said than done.
That's right.
You ask them to check. You ask them to, you know, study for themselves, their electricity bills and all that. I mean, good.
I tried it for my water bills.
If the other person on the other side of the line can't even explain it themselves to the consumer, that's where the problem lies as well.
That's why we have this recorded information education campaign materials because we can review them anytime. Because in the end, kasi, it's really how you fight for your rights. Now, what I'm saying is inform us if the distribution utility is not paying attention to your complaints. And that we have a consumer welfare and promotion office to address that, which is manned by 6 people for the entire country. So that's how it goes. So sinasabi natin.
Okay, wait. They're telling us, Undersecretary, sorry, but they're telling us to wrap up. And I do have 2 more points to bring up.
Yes.
First of all, number one, it's all about fighting for your rights. I beg to disagree.
Of course.
Why do you even have to fight for it when it should be enshrined in the first place?
It's there, but there will be violations. Same as human rights. It's there, but there will be violations. That's what you were talking about earlier. But also, we have 2 LNG facilities, liquefied nat gas, that will be online and commercially available next year. Hmm. So AGP will be available if the reports as of June will stand by June 2022. And first gen partnership with Tokyo Gas will be online September 2022. That is to address the declining output of Malampaya so that we can use the power plants. That is 20% of Luzon that can provide electricity. But if there will be kulang na nat gas, the nat gas plants can shift to alternate fuel. Yun nga lang mas mahal.
One final point to the issue of the unreliability of coal-fired power plants. Your answer to that this the power outages basically underscores the unreliability of these plants. Go ahead, Undersecretary.
We saw that already because we have an observation from ASEC Dilola and the Power Bureau team that we have too much baseload non-flexible plants in the system. That's why Secretary Cusi last year issued that coal moratorium. What is that saying? It's saying that we have too much baseload, inflexible, not flexible plants in the system. And the tendency, if we use them for flexible function, to ramp them up and ramp them down, they break down. So if the system does not sink in with the demand, ibig sabihin, kulang yung flexible plants mo, tapos gumagalaw yung demand mo na kailangan yung flexibility, pag minatch mo siya ng coal or baseload plant na hindi flexible, nagkakaroon ng breakdown. Hmm. So yun yung sinasabi natin na mag-comply kasi lahat. Kasi pati sa competitive selection process, dapat nakaklassify yan. Meralco, baseload. Meralco, for example, medium range or peaking requirement. Dapat nakamatch. Dapat transparent para alam ng mga tao kung paano binibili yung supply na ipapasa sa kanila. Sabi rin ng DOE, wala na yung mga hidden pass-on. Kasi yung sa 2018 policy, we cannot hide the volatility of fuel prices at ipapasa kay Carmina Constantino sa power bill niya. Hindi pwede. Dapat alam ni Carmina or alam ni consumer kung ano na talaga yung babayaran niya.
Okay.
So wala na mga pang nakatago. Ganun lang po.
All right. Sorry, but we've run out of time. Energy Undersecretary Wimpy Fuentebella there. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Take care. Keep safe.
Take care. Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate it. We're going to take a break now. Still ahead, Philippine tax officials, well, they're coming up with an initial list of social media influencers facing tax compliance checks. More details when we come back. Stay with us here on ANC. Back with more news. At least 250 social media influencers are being investigated by the Bureau of Internal Revenue to check if they're paying their dues. Our correspondent, Warren de Guzman, joins us now on the line for more details. Warren, go ahead.
Hi, Carmina. The Bureau of Internal Revenue has informed the Finance Department it is investigating an initial list of around 250 social media influencers to check their tax compliance. BIR Deputy Commissioner Arnel Gubalia said in his report to Secretary Carlos Dominguez, and I quote, "We encourage them to register, and then we have the profiling of over 250 personalities. We will do the investigation so that they would pay the necessary corresponding tax on their earnings." The BIR says it has already sent out letters of authority for the conduct of investigation to the top earning influencers. The BIR released Revenue Memorandum Circular 97-2021 last month. Under the MC, social media influencers are mandated to pay income tax and percentage tax, or if applicable, value-added tax, as mandated under the National Internal Revenue Code and other existing laws. The circular defined influencers as those who derive their income from YouTube, affiliate marketing, photo and video sales, digital courses, and podcasts and webinars, among others. When that MC came out, it caused quite a stir, and there were reports of some social media influencers closing their accounts. The BIR was criticized by netizens for the circular as well, with some going as far as accusing government of stifling the digital economy. Tax expert and BIR consultant Mona Brea says the BIR is only doing its job in implementing the tax code. Several social media influencers have come out to say they are ready to comply. However, some say the government has yet to pass the necessary laws to create the implementing rules and regulations for taxing online income, noting the proposals to do so are still pending in Congress. But again, the BIR says the National Internal Revenue Code itself states all income is taxable unless exempted by law. It adds NC 97-2021 was also issued as a means to address that while Congress debates digital taxation laws. The BIR also noted it has the power to obtain information from foreign tax authorities through relevant tax treaties and can verify influencer income with treaty partners. It warns social media influencers to voluntarily and truthfully declare their income and pay the corresponding taxes or face a formal investigation for tax evasion and possible penalties. Carmina, back to you.
Thanks a lot, Warren. Take care and you keep safe. Well, before we go, more than a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, the Philippines continues to log record high numbers of new coronavirus cases. The question is, how did we get here? And is the Philippines on the path to recovery, or is a bigger crisis on the horizon? Catch ANC Presents COVID-19 in Numbers. I'll be joined by the head of ABS-CBN's data analytics team, Edson Guido, as you take a deep dive into the country's COVID-19. Numbers. The special comes out later this evening at 6. And that'll do it for today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, Dateline Philippines podcast is on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Play back this newscast too on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on ANC.